This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded earlier this week with The Daily Show's Jon Stewart. Last summer, Stewart took a leave of absence from The Daily Show to make the film Rosewater, which is now in theaters. Rosewater marks Stewart's debut as a screenwriter and film director. He doesn't appear in the film, but he is part of the story. The movie's adapted from a memoir by journalist Mazyar Bahari, who was born and raised in Iran. In 2009, while Bahari was living in England, he went back to Iran to cover the presidential election and subsequent protests challenging the results that kept President Ahmadinejad in power. After Bahari shot news video of the protests, he was arrested. During his 118 days in solitary confinement, he was beaten, tortured, and accused of being a spy. One of the pieces of evidence his torturer used to try and prove he was a spy was a satirical report Bahari appeared in on The Daily Show, recorded just days before his imprisonment. For the piece, which was intended to satirize the stereotype so many Americans have of Iranians as being part of the axis of evil, Daily Show correspondent Jason Jones went to Iran where he spoke to Iranians. In the segment, Jones is dressed like a spy in a B-movie, and he's interviewing Bahari in a cafe.
The one thing I could understand was that this entire country is evil.
The first thing to know about Iran is that it's not evil. Iranians and Americans, they have much more in common than they have difference.
What do I have in common with you?
Who is number one enemy of the United States?
Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda is also the number one enemy of Iran. According to Al-Qaeda members, any Shia, any Iranian has to be killed. And if you kill an Iranian, you would go to heaven and you will have 72 virgins.
Enough of his Western-educated Newsweek doublespeak.
Jon Stewart actually recreated some of that Daily Show report for the film Rosewater. Before we get to Terry's interview with Jon Stewart, let's hear a scene from Rosewater in which Mazyar Bahari's interrogator uses the Daily Show report as evidence that Bahari is a spy. The scene starts with Bahari, played by Gael Garcia Bernal, denying that he's a spy.
Sir, you're making a big mistake. I am a journalist. That's it. Nothing more.
Just a journalist.
Yes.
As a spy, I'm just trying to figure out why your country is so terrifying.
The first thing to know about Iran is that it is not evil. Americans and Iranians have a lot of things in common more than they have differences.
What do I have in common with you?
So can you tell me why just journalist meet up with this American spy on the evil journalist?
He's not a spy.
He's not a spy?
It's a show.
It's a show?
A comedy show. It's stupid.
It's very stupid, yes.
He's a comedian pretending to be a spy.
So can you tell me why American pretending to be a spy had chosen to interview you?
And why would a real spy have a TV show?
Jon Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the film. It's great to talk with you again. So did you ever think that one of your segments from The Daily Show could be used as evidence by an interrogator, evidence that a political prisoner had been spying?
I always assumed that somewhere one of our bits would be used like that. Just didn't think it would be this one. I think it just reaffirms that sense that you always have that you cannot outsmart crazy. You can't ever imagine how someone might weaponize idiocy. The idea that Jason Jones in a keffiyeh wearing sunglasses sitting in a cafe in Tehran saying, you know, I'm an American spy, and as a spy, I'd like to know why your country is so terrifying. I think the difficult factor there is to wonder, do they truly believe it's evidence, or is it kind of a cynical manipulation?
Yes, exactly. Right.
Right. You're just never quite sure, because the idea that an individual could look at that and think, now I know it's probably unusual for a spy to have his own television show and to announce he's a spy on the show. Geez, that's awfully damning evidence. it's very difficult to wrap your head around that type of thing.
Well, not only didn't the interrogator seem to realize that this was satire, he also didn't comprehend that the point of the piece was Iranians aren't evil. Like, Iranian people are like us.
Well, I think that, oddly enough, I think that is what was infuriating to them about the piece, I think, was not the spying issue, but that Mazyar stated in it that Americans and Iranians have things in common. And I think the idea that America, that you could somehow find common cause with the great Satan, was the most problematic part of the piece. The idea that Iranians and Americans are, you know, similar on the scale of humanity.
So how did you first hear that Maziar was in prison?
So there were three individuals that we also interviewed. There was Maziar, Ibrahim Yazdi, and there was a cleric, sort of a moderate cleric, I think by the name of Abdi. So Jason and Tim got back from Iran, edited the pieces. We were getting ready, I think, to air the first piece, or we might have already aired the first piece when we found out not just Maziar, but that all three had been arrested. But obviously, within the context of a much larger sweep of the country, it wasn't as though it appeared that Iran had cracked down on the three individuals who talked with our show. There was a much broader crackdown on reformist elements after the 2009 election. So we always viewed it in that context. We never thought, my God, the government of Iran has targeted Daily Show participants. It was clearly a much broader picture than that.
How did you first hear that your segment on the Daily Show was used as evidence that Maziar Bahari was a spy?
Maziar told us that one. was one that we didn't find that out until much later, when Maziar had been released, and then he wrote an article about it and came on the program. That's when we first found out about that.
So what was your reaction when you first heard?
I believe I might have uttered the phrase, are you, and with some profane adjective, are you kidding me? You know, again, it's so surreal and is so absurd that it's hard to imagine it as not farce. It's hard. And that was actually one of the difficulties with the film, was not creating any sort of element around it, any sort of heightened absurdity, any sort of caricatured portrayals that might remove for the audience the sense of how truly absurd it was in reality. I think if we had created in that environment sort of characters for black comedy, it could have really detracted from just how truly bizarre it was in reality.
So did this whole experience make you more paranoid about unintended, devious uses of your satirical material?
No. You know, and it's a phrase I think I've used before. You can't censor yourself for someone else's ignorance. There is no way to understand. What they utilized was it was innocuous, and they used it. They weaponized it. So in the sense that how could you possibly conduct your life in a way that would not allow them? It was just pretense. If it wasn't that, they would have used something else. And they did. They used his Facebook pages against him. The idea that he was on an Anton Chekhov fan page, they used against him. You know Anton Chekhov, the famed Zionist.
Yes. Is Anton Chekhov Jewish?
So, yeah. Right. Is Anton Chekhov Jewish? Is he a Zionist? You know, you could say, well, geez, they used it against them. Does that make you more cautious? It doesn't, in the same way that they used against him completely innocuous dinner parties that he went to and accused him of spying because of that. Does that mean you don't go to dinner parties anymore?
While we're on the subject of Jews, one of the things...
Maybe the best segue in Terry Gross history. That is a fresh air. If that doesn't go on the Christmas party reel, I don't know what will. While we're on the subject of Jews...
One of the things that the interrogator accused, yes, Maziar Bahari of doing was receiving orders from foreigners and Zionists. He was accused of being in contact with Jews and Israelis. Do you think they, yes, knew that John Stewart is Jewish?
Yes, they did. They have, I think, a pretty full list. I don't know if they got it from Adam Sandler's Hanukkah song, but wherever they got it from, I think they have a pretty extensive list of who is of the Hebraic faith and who is not. That being said, you know, that is their, you know, again, to slightly humanize the situation, this is a gentleman who has been taught for many, many years that these two groups are his enemy.
You mean the interrogator? You're talking about the interrogator.
Exactly. We tried to draw a line, you know, of what's evil and what's ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think evil is a pretty rare quality. And I imagine at the very top of that food chain is the hint of something more nefarious. But underneath it is ignorance. And the ignorance can go pretty well distributed on both sides in the sense that, you know, we are coming from a place where we refer to them as an axis of evil, and they're coming from a place where they refer to us as the great Satan. So clearly the conversation is taking place on a relatively one-dimensional caricatured level. And within that is how these types of ignorant misstatements metastasize. You know, look, they are not without precedent to think that Western elements would use journalists and saboteurs to try and overthrow their government. We actually did do that in 1953. And not that planting that seed is what caused Maziar to be arrested, but certainly giving them that pretense doesn't help.
So, you know, I'm not sure how to ask this, so I'll just put it this way. Did Maziar play on any guilt to get you to write and direct the movie?
Listen, as a Jew, I am immune. I am immune to people being able to use guilt against me. There is no way that he could ever match my mother. You know, generally, if I am going to be prey to guilt, it's merely just to come visit. It's not to spend that much time writing and directing. Originally, you know, when we met, we used to meet for breakfast and just became friendly after he was released. And he'd be passing through New York and we'd just sort of hang out and talk just family and politics and culture and what was happening in the world. And he had been writing this memoir. And originally, I was going to just try and help him get it made into a movie, maybe produce it. And it was more a function. It was not guilt as much as impatience that I think, you know, for about a year, we were sending it to various writers that, you know, we put together these lists of writers that we really admire and writers that we would love to take a crack at it and maybe some directors that might. But it turns out those people are loved and admired by many people and many people with money who already have them working on a lot of other projects. So given that I thought this story was so relevant and should be told as a current event and not as an artifact of history, it really became my impatience with sort of the glacial process that drove me into writing it.
It's interesting that you decided to do, you know, a serious film as opposed to a comedy as your directorial mm-hmm. debut, because you always describe yourself as a comic. Like people like me say, no, you're really a journalist too. And you go, no, I'm really, really a comic.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot of like absurd elements in the story, you know,
yes.
absurdities that are inherent in the story. But the film is by no means a comedy. So did you feel like you were drawing on like different muscles and different sections of your brain to do the film?
That's interesting. You know, it's not so much different sections of the brain, because I think the process of drama is not particularly different from the process of comedy, you know, in terms of, you know, there were times I think I had to restrain myself. You know, I think there's always the sense when you're a comic, you know, hey, you know what would go well in this scene? A banana peel. Why don't we stick that right on the floor? You know? There was maybe exercising a certain amount of restraint more than it was completely operating in an alien environment or an alien medium. Because the process of breaking a story, of deconstructing the narrative, of creating that narrative arc is not so different from what we do on a daily basis at the show and the collaborative nature of the production. You know, obviously it's not ephemeral in the way that topical comedy might be, but it certainly, I never felt like, so this is what it's like to be serious. You know, it always, you know, underpinning satire is always a sense that you have a visceral reaction to something or that you truly care about an issue that you're trying to satirize.
And on your show, there's often a lot at stake. I mean, usually somebody isn't put in prison as a result of one of your sketches, but you're dealing with
right.
real people and real issues that are very important. So,
right, right. And in the sense that people would say, like, you know, the fake newsman becomes a real director. Like, we're not, we're making jokes about, we're not creating
right.
false news. We're making jokes about things that are actually happening.
You shot the movie in Jordan because you couldn't very well go to Iran. They would have probably put you in jail.
Yes.
Probably, right? So
it's so hard to say, but they definitely would not have granted us a permit to film.
Yes. So how did Jordan become the place to shoot?
Well, there was, you know, the real consideration there is how do you find a place that can stand in for the variety of exteriors that you're going to need? And those exteriors range from, you know, Maziar's mother's neighborhood, which is sort of a middle class neighborhood in Tehran, and Robot Karim, which is a lower class neighborhood in Tehran. And then some of the campaign headquarters and just some of the general cafes and things like that. And then you have the practical considerations, which are we don't have any money. So it's not as though we can recreate any of it. It's not as though we could shoot a few exteriors in Jordan and then come back to New York and shoot the rest in New York.
When Maziar Bahari was in Evin prison in Iran, when they were holding him as a political prisoner, the interrogator told him, "We can find you anywhere. We can put you in a bag no matter where in the world you are. No one can escape from us." And Maziar says that the interrogator's parting words to him when Maziar was getting out of prison was, "Remember the bag." So was...
Yeah. Was they actually asked him out to coffee, if you can imagine. You know, they... After he was released from prison, before he actually left the country, so this is in sort of the 3 or 4 day period that he was still there, his interrogator and Hajaga, who was the boss, took him out for tea and cake. And they sat in a cafe and had tea and cake. It's absurd. And, yeah. And said to him, "By the way, just to let you know, we can always bring you back in a bag and, you know, enjoy the sponge cake." So it's a truly terrifying situation that he found himself in.
So was he on the set with you in Amman, or was Amman Jordan too close to Iran for him to feel safe?
No. Maziar was there the only time that he was gone. There were certain scenes, some of the scenes that we did, you know, that involved his sister. He was very close to his sister, and I think those were still emotionally... If there was anything that was too close, it was the emotional feeling he still had surrounding his sister and his feelings in that regard. And so he wasn't on set for those scenes. And then he was back in London, I think, for a couple of days on some business matters, some personal matters. But for the most part, he was there the entire time. And he does not restrict his travel. He's relentless. And I think feels that part of the process of transforming his ordeal into something more positive is reclaiming his freedom and reclaiming expression. And, you know, they also told him, you know, when you get out, you say nothing. I think literally on the plane as he was flying back to London, he was composing the article he was going to write for Newsweek in part of his memoir.
I really admire him.
He's a brave dude.
Yeah. What kind of security did you have on the set in Amman Jordan?
Mostly Maziar. He's also a very tough dude. Nobody knows. You know, nobody has that thick a head of black hair and can't handle himself in a street fight. I mean, I think generally most sets have, I guess, security or people watching the stuff. So nobody takes your camera, that sort of thing. But nothing out of the ordinary. You know, conditions on the ground in Jordan are not in any way volatile. They were not, you know, the Syrian civil war was about 50 miles away. But the general tenor of Amman is very calm.
You shot in a functioning prison.
Yes.
That's weird, was, right? Yeah. I mean, there were actual prisoners in prison where you were shooting?
Yes. Yeah, so it's not like shooting like on the street where people come up and go, "Hey, what are you guys filming?" Like, you don't get, there's not, you know, you don't have prisoners coming up like, "Hey, is this a commercial? This looks awesome. Who's in it? Am I in it? Am I in solitary? What did I do? Did I kill somebody? What? What's going on? Do you need extras?" You don't get any of that. They're more just looking at you like, "Really? You're shooting a film here about prison? Great. That's great."
What kind of prison is it?
It was more modern. You know, you kind of had your choice. We did our recce and we had our choice of where there was sort of the more the dark dungeonous, the older prisons where you got the sense, you know, kind of the ghosts of the anguish cries of people that had been held there. And then there were sort of the more modern, more antiseptic prisons. And Maziar was very clear that Evin was much more along the lines of those bureaucratic, institutionalized prisons and much less of that kind of Midnight Express vibe.
Who did you have to convince in Jordan to allow you to shoot in the prison?
That's an excellent question. And, From what I understand, you know, Jordan has a sort of a new, it's nascent, but a flourishing film industry. So it's not as though they had never had somebody from a film crew come in and say, hey, we're doing a film. Jordan generally stands in for films that deal with this type of subject matter. So they're, you know, I think they would have been more surprised if I came over and said, hey, can we use Jordan to shoot a rom-com? I've got Sandra Bullock and I've got Ryan Reynolds. And here's what I want them to do. I want them to meet cute outside a hummus cafe. And, you know, I think if we had done that, they would have been more surprised. But for an American crew to come over there and say, hey, do you have a prison we could borrow? I think they were pretty accustomed to that.
So you shot during Ramadan, right?
Yes, I wanted to make sure that every challenging thing that could happen to us, I wanted to make sure it was summer, I wanted to make sure it was really hot, and I wanted to make sure that the crew was fasting. And during Ramadan, you know, in a Sunni country, they pray five times a day. And in a Sunni country, generally, the mosques are, you know, 250 yards apart. You know, if we had shot in Iran, they pray in the Shia country, they would pray three times a day. And there really are not that many, you know, mosques with loudspeakers and all that. So we also had the call to prayer. And within that, there were usually special different prayers that they would do during Ramadan, like the one for the iftar, which is the break of the fast at night, would be a little bit longer. And we had our sound man, Falah, was very devout. And so we could always turn to him and say, what do we got here, Falah? And he'd say, this first prayer is 2 minutes. Then you will wait a minute. Then there will be 15 minutes. You know, so we would always have to judge our production schedule based on that.
You know, one of the things I always ask myself when I see a movie or read a memoir about somebody who is in prison for political reasons and is tortured is like, could I possibly withstand that? And right. I'm sure that's a question you had to ask yourself while working closely with Maziar, who I think has probably become a very close friend of yours as well as like a working partner. And then, you know, as the writer and director, you had to put yourself in his shoes. And that's part of your job. So when you asked yourself if you were literally in his shoes, if you could have withstood that, what did it make you think about? And do you think you could have?
In that scenario, in that hypothesis, and I have replayed it many times, I tend not to fare that well. I tend not to be the hero of that story. I tend to break relatively quickly, as I imagine it going through. But I also think that it's very difficult to place yourself under that type of circumstance and duress through pure imagination and true hypothesis. I think Maziar's ability to retain his sense of humor, he, in some ways, he was the canary in the coal mine of something that I have thought for a long time, which is that humor survives in the bleakest of conditions. And in some ways, not only survives in the bleakest of conditions, but you know how there's the old, you know, laughter is the best medicine. And I always think, well, yes, except for, of course, medicine. Medicine's really a very good medicine. I think the idea that under these incredibly harsh conditions, not only did his humor survive, his humor sustained him. And I found that incredibly empowering to an extent in that I always felt that, you know, people always say, you know, is that an appropriate joke? Is it appropriate to joke about that subject? And I always want to say, not only is it appropriate to joke about that subject, but I think it's essential to joke about it because, you know, I always have the sense that even in the darkest of times, you know, I've always had this experience at funerals or in a time of, you know, of great worry, a joke can kind of re-energize or reconfigure a room or bring people back to life to some extent. And his ability to do that for himself in the absence of audience, I thought was remarkable. I think that humor played a really important role for Maziar in sustaining himself throughout that kind of ordeal. And I found that gratifying.
Well, you know, you said humor sustaining him even in the absence of an audience. But that that's really interesting in the sense that comedy is something that works best when it's shared with somebody, it doesn't have to be an audience. It could just be a friend or a stranger who you're sharing an observation with. But like how sustaining is humor when it's just you all alone? And certainly the interrogator isn't in on the joke. That's not going to be helpful.
That's the disassociative nature of solitary confinement. And that is the challenge of solitary confinement.
Yeah.
Because Maziar had to create the entire ecosystem with which he could survive in. And so the way that he did it, you know, one of the things that's also interesting about it is humor is the antidote to dogma and to this kind of certainty of truth.
You're describing all the reasons why, you know, we all love your show. So, no,
well,
seriously.
I don't know. This is under very separate circumstances and very real circumstances.
No, I understand. I understand.
But so within that, he's now falling back on all these things that kind of create his humanity, his love of culture, his love of his family, his ability to know that if they were there, these are the things he would be sharing with them. It was sort of that idea of creating kind of a rich tapestry of all those memories and then beginning to interact with those memories in a way that you would if they were there. So it's sort of a magic trick. It's a conjuring of sorts.
One of the big shifts of doing a movie, I would imagine, is switching from a daily show to a long-term project like a film. There was a long period of overlap between the two when you were writing the film and still doing the daily show. But for the shoot, you were able to take a leave. But, you know, just from my experiences doing a daily show, there's a certain amount of delusion involved. Like at the end of the show, you go, "Yay, it's done!" And then,
I would like to see Terry Gross say "Yay" at the end of a show.
But then there's this voice in back of your head saying, "Like, are you kidding? There's another show tomorrow, and you'd better start working on it."
Yeah,
but
man.
At least there's
no
that,
savor. You get no savor.
Yeah, but there's that moment of delusion where you go, "Oh, it's done," and you never get that. I imagine making a film. So that's also probably like recalibration, where you have to get into this mindset of like it's going to be a real, real long time before this is done. What was that like for you, taking on a long-term project?
Right. What's so seductive, I think, about doing a daily show is exactly that sense of accomplishment at the end of the day, where you sort of get the sense that, man, we did it. It is that rhythm of completion that I think is very seductive and very rewarding within that. I think part of the issue with the film is I didn't realize at each turn how much further I had to go. And I think sometimes it's sort of that sense of, do you know when you're lost on a highway and you feel like you're in this strange limbo land until you get back to that exit that you knew,
the familiar
now you're back
thing.
On track?
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So until you get back to that tent post, you feel as though you're in kind of a strange limbo of time is not passing, distance is not passing, because I'm lost. When you're lost, and there was a little bit of that, when I finished the script, I felt like, I'm done! And obviously, then you have to cast it. And it's a constant process of revision and revisiting. But the rewarding aspect of that is I felt like at each turn, there were opportunities to improve it.
John Stewart wrote and directed the new film Rosewater. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. We all know the expression, you can't tell a book by its cover. But the truth is that publishers put a lot of time and effort into designing book covers and jackets that are distinctive, eye-catching, and in some way authentic expressions of the material within. Our guest, Peter Mendelsohn, has designed more than 600 book covers, ranging from classics like Crime and Punishment to contemporary novels like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Now he's designed covers for two recent books of his own. One is a collection of hundreds of his book covers, including many that were rejected, along with commentaries on his technique. The other book, titled What We See When We Read, is about how words give rise to images in our minds. Mendelsohn spent years as a classical pianist before teaching himself design. Now he's the associate art director at Knopf and the art director at Pantheon Books. We spoke last month. Well, Peter Mendelson, welcome to Fresh Air. You write that the best jackets are the ones that try and capture, paraphrasing here, the meaning of a book, what you call a parallel.
I'm very interested in what the author's project is. And in that way, I think as a jacket designer, you sort of have to read like an editor or a critic does. You want to be immersed in the text as you're reading it, but you also want to sort of pull out the strands that kind of indicate why the author wrote this book instead of another book. And those things are never really obvious. They're tacit in the text, and it means you have to read closely to determine what exactly the message here is. Sometimes it's, you know, you'll come across a scene that feels particularly pregnant, or there'll be a metaphor that feels like somehow that one metaphor can sort of stand as the emblem for the entire book. But there is a moment when I'm reading an author's manuscript where I just, all of a sudden, it kind of comes to me, well, this is that thing. This is the one specific that can stand in for this entire text.
So take us through the process, if you can. I mean, how do you go from reading the text to getting a cover?
Well, when I'm reading, I'm marking up the text, and I'm just trying to be very alert for anything in that text that has sort of structural importance or a particular kind of emotional weight, or I'm trying to establish sort of what the affect of the book is in general, because, you know, mood is very important on a book jacket, so... Not that books sort of come prepackaged with one particular affect, but, you know, you're just trying to translate the feeling of what it's like to read that book. So I sort of mark up the manuscript as I'm going, you know, anytime there's something that I think could be potentially, you know, that symbol, that thing that could sort of represent the text as a whole. And then when I have a sketch that seems like it could be compelling in some way, then I render it more fully. I'll make a collage or take a photo, or I'll work on the computer, or I'll set the typography. There's a lot of trial and error in it. I mean, it's mostly trial and error, honestly. But while I'm designing, I'm then just looking at the things that I've made to see if they feel consonant with the way that I felt when I was reading. And that's really the moment when you know if you've made a book jacket that works. If you're designing something and you look at it and you think, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm feeling very similar to the way that I was feeling as I was reading this book, then you know you've succeeded.
One of the authors who you did covers for, Ben Marcus, said he was amazed that you seem not to just have read, but to have studied his book. And this struck me as interesting because I have to say, one of the things that I do in this job and that Terry Gross does in this job is to read a lot of books. And the more closely and carefully we read, obviously, the better prepared we are for an interview. But it takes a lot of time. And it made me think, is a lot of your workday just reading?
Yep. Actually, that's exactly right. It's always surprising to people when they come to my office or they walk by my door and they see me with my feet kicked up with a manuscript. But, you know, I read constantly from the moment that I wake up till the moment that I go to sleep. I read on the subway. I read when I'm walking from the subway to my office. One learns that there is an immense amount of sort of interstitial moments in the day where one can kind of cram in another chapter. I'm sure you've had this experience as well. But the fact that I'm in this job in the first place is because I like to spend most of my waking hours reading. I mean, I've always been someone who loves books, and I consider it sort of a bonus of the job that that I get to do this work. Of course, sort of the more I hesitate to say successful, but the more successful you are at the job, the more work you have to do, and as a result, the reading really piles up. And you know, I do worry a little bit that, you know, at the end of my career, if reading a book will just end up being a busman's holiday and I'll never read another book again. I'm hoping this doesn't ruin reading for me.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, our guest is Peter Mendelson. He designs book covers and has a new book, a big coffee table book with lots of the book covers he has designed in which he explains how his craft works. He's also written a book called What We See When We Read. This book, What We See When We Read, is really interesting, and I found as I looked through it and I read it, it's very visual. It was hard to come up with questions. It just kind of is. It tells us something about the reading process. You point out that when we read, we never really picture the characters that we're introduced to in any really clear, vivid way, right? What does that tell us?
I'm not really sure what it tells us. I mean, one of the reasons I think it's hard to come up with questions about the book is that I don't really provide any answers. And as I was writing the book, I was worried that that would be irritating to people. But I'm just, you know, I'm not particularly qualified. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not a professional philosopher. I'm just not that qualified to talk about mental content and what it is and how it comes to be. How I am qualified is that, you know, I read books all the time and try to visualize their contents. So I have this sort of working knowledge of the imagination in that sense. And, you know, I just found that as I was trying to kind of introspectively examine the way that I was imagining works of fiction, I found that if I sort of, you know, if I looked at the things that I was imagining as closely as I could, I would find that they weren't the things that I was imagining that I was imagining, if that makes any sense. That they weren't, you know, when I was thinking of Anna Karenina, I wasn't actually quite imagining a person. Or if I was, I was imagining a very specific person that I knew, say, a relative. And yet when we sort of describe the reading experience, we describe this metaphor of kind of watching a film, that we see the author's work sort of projected in our minds, and we sort of watch that image kind of passively. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought maybe that metaphor was misleading, in the sense that, you know, not only are we not picturing what, you know, the author's world, the author gives us very few prompts when it comes to describing characters, authors in general. I mean, authors can't tell us everything about characters. That would make very, very tedious books. But that we were sort of making these things ourselves out of our memories, and that the process was just much more weird than I had previously thought.
No, it is fascinating. When I read this, I thought, yeah, when I'm reading a book, the author is describing what the characters are doing or saying, and I have some sort of an image. But when I try and really picture what that character's face looks like, it's not there. It's kind of blank.
Yeah, no, it's an odd thing. And for me, the tip-off was really Anna Karenina. You know, reading that book, I realized that there were very, very few descriptions of the main character in that book, that we know very little about her, that she has black curly hair and that she has small hands and that she's slightly plump, and that's just about it. And yet I had always had the feeling that I was imagining this fully fleshed out person, that if she were to walk by me on the street, I would stop her and say, "Hey, Anna Karenina." But in fact, as I said, if you sort of try to think about what you're actually picturing, there's really not that much there.
Is there a book that you've always thought you'd love to do a cover for and never had the chance to?
Yeah, I've always wanted to work on, you know, any of Virginia Woolf's novels. She's always been one of my favorite writers and is probably one of the greatest writers. It's sort of describing the feeling of being, and I mean just in the sort of sensory way, like the kind of sense data that comes into us. She describes that so beautifully. And it would be a very difficult assignment, but it's one that I've always wanted and nobody's ever given me.
Well, here's hoping you get it.
Thank you.
Well, Peter Mendelsohn, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Mendelsohn has designed more than 600 book covers. Many are collected in his book titled Cover. Mendelsohn's also the author of the book What We See When We Read. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Bob Dylan's career was interrupted in 1966 when he crashed his motorcycle while riding near his home in upstate New York. He wasn't badly injured, but used the occasion to disengage from the grind of touring he'd been doing to relax and hang out with his band. During this hiatus, some tapes surfaced of new songs he'd been writing, the infamous Basement Tapes. On the occasion of the entire archive being released, rock historian Ed Ward has these thoughts.
Big dumb blonde with a wheel all gorged, and Turtle, that friend of hers, with his checks all forged, his cheeks in a chunk with his cheese in the cash. They're all gonna be there at that million dollar bash. Ooh, baby, ooh, yeah.
first thing to know is that the basement tapes weren't entirely recorded in the basement. Some were recorded in a room in Bob Dylan's house, known as the Red Room, which of course wasn't red. Some were recorded at a house rented by Rick Danko and Levon Helm. And some, yes, were recorded in the basement of the Big Pink House in Saugerties, New York, that the band used as their clubhouse. As far as can be determined, this all started around February 1967 and continued at odd intervals for about a year. The Red Room tapes were, for want of a better term, folk jam sessions. Dylan hauled out old favorites, and the band improvised arrangements around them. There were Hank Williams songs, Johnny Cash songs, Irish songs learned from Dylan's friend Tommy Makem, a couple of Canadian songs the band would know, and a few rather undistinguished Dylan originals. The whole thing just gives the impression of friends fooling around, far from the intensity of Bob Dylan and the band on their 1965 and 66 tour. His physical convalescence was long over, but Dylan was in no rush to engage with the public again. He'd gotten married, started a family, and liked the unhurried life he was living. But he was also a songwriter, and he was writing songs. That summer, the jam session moved to the basement, which was probably cooler, and the faithful tape recorder, manned by keyboardist Garth Hudson, followed along.
If your memory serves you well, we were going to again and wait. So I'm going to unpack all my things and sit before it gets too late. No man alive will come to you with another tale to tell. And you know that we shall meet our
Here, they recorded the songs that formed the legend. These were better crafted than the variations on folk songs they recorded in the Red Room and were originals. It was apparently Dylan's plan to write songs for others for a while, thereby providing him with an income without having to hit the road. His publishing company, Dwarf Music, would circulate a demo tape of them to bands Dylan specified. Manfred Mann with Quinn the Eskimo, Julie Driscoll, Brian Auger and the Trinity with This Wheel's on Fire, the Byrds with You Ain't Going Nowhere. The band, too, recorded a healthy number for their debut album, Music from Big Pink, which featured a cover painting by Dylan. These demo tapes circulated widely. I first heard these songs on a reel-to-reel tape a guy I knew in college lent me, given to him by his father, who worked at Columbia Screen Gems, which administered Dwarf Music's copyrights. And a few months later, there was the first of the infamous bootlegs, Great White Wonder. Dylan's lawyers tried to find the bootleggers, but Dylan dismissed this remarkable body of work as stuff written for others, which he certainly wouldn't have released himself.
They say everything can be replaced, yet every distance is not near.
Well, he wrote them, so of course his opinion matters, but I can't help but think that beyond the deeply rooted lyrics and the folk-based melodies, what people responded to was the sound of a star at his most relaxed, making music he had no intention of releasing. In short, enjoying himself amidst other musicians doing the same. No matter who the artist, no matter what the era, that's rare and welcome.
Rock historian Ed Ward reviewed Bob Dylan and the Band, The Basement Tapes Complete.
Clouds so swift, rain won't lift, gate won't close, ratings froze. Get your mind off winter time, you ain't going nowhere.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.